Welcome to Behind the Curtain, LA Opera's podcast series in which we look deeply at the creative process and explore opera's enduring themes and power to move us.
Highway 1 USA is an opera about family. Listen in as affiliated scholar Dr. Christy Brown Montesano and the granddaughter of William Grant Still, Celeste Headlee, discuss who Still was at home and how the powerful women in his life influenced the drama we see unfold on stage. Tickets are available now at laopera.org.
Hello, I'm Dr. Christy Brown Montesano. I'm a lecturer at UCLA in musicology and an affiliated scholar with Los Angeles Opera. And I'm delighted to be here today to speak with Celeste Headlee, who is a recognized journalist and radio host, a professional speaker and author of numerous books, but also the granddaughter of composer William Grant Still. Welcome, Celeste.
Thanks for having me.
So do you have particular memories of your grandfather? Things that stick out, just that you have insight into him as a person?
Grandfather was my favorite person in the world of pretty much my entire young life until he passed away. First of all, I'd say that music surrounded him and all of us growing up. He had an entire closet that was full of reel-to-reel tapes and other recordings made of his works and also some of his favorite works. He had a massive cabinet full of LPs, and he would sometimes get his stick and conduct along. You know, my grandmother is a concert pianist. That's how they met. And so she would go to the piano in the back and sometimes play, and we'd all sing, and he would take me to the piano and teach me how to play Inchworm. And, you know, music was always, it was part of literally everything. I remember sitting at the dinner table and saying something nasty about one of my schoolmates, and he started chanting that Jester Hairston tune, "Gossip, gossip, evil ting, not much unhappiness you bring. If you can't say something nice, don't talk at all," is my advice. Dogs and children were his favorites. And he was a devoted gardener, so much so that eventually he had so much leftover produce from his little garden patch in Los Angeles that his neighbors would start closing their windows when he came down the street with a basket full of squash. And he was a very skilled carpenter. I still have at least one of his tables that he made. He made all kinds of things, serving trays and furniture, coffee tables, circus sets for the kids. He created little miniature dioramas that were sets of some of his operas and ballets. He was extremely handy with his hands.
I'm loving the squash cart. I love the idea of him walking down the street and that person who's so good at it that they have an abundance of produce to give away. And the dioramas of the operas, that's so wonderful. And so you can understand why you found him to be such a magical person, your favorite person. I mean, the creativity is extraordinary.
His spirit was very childlike. I mean, he was not one of those adults who doesn't remember how to be joyful and playful. He was. And, you know, it even crept into his music. If you see his original handwritten scores, some of them done on his music typewriter, he would doodle in the in the margins. You know, I know at the end of Black Man Dances, there's a whole bunch of little characters of a figure dancing, and it says, "He finished, he's finally done." But he would put these little wry remarks in his scores too. He was an extremely gentle soul, and he loved us. I mean, his grandchildren, we could not have done any wrong. We did a lot of wrong. He would not have believed it. So, I mean, what could you ask for as a child?
As a musicologist, as a music historian, and someone who speaks a lot about music, I mean, it's that connection of actually being able to picture the Lazy Boy and Bonanza. I mean, it is that human aspect that we often lose when we talk about creative artists. And it all comes down, you know, of course, the works are important to those artists, and that is a legacy. But for me, I always feel that getting some of that humanity, reading letters, reading diaries, and we're very lucky that your family has kept so many of those so that we can see that inside person, that childlike but very serious artist that was William Grant Still. I also wanted, since we're here in Los Angeles for the double bill where Highway 1 USA is being performed by the Los Angeles Opera, your family has a very strong relationship to the Los Angeles area. I mean, your grandmother was born here, is that right?
That's right. He was born in Mississippi and then grew up in Little Rock. He went to college in Ohio, first Wilberforce and then Oberlin. And then he went to New York, where he did all kinds of different things in music. He hated the winter. He hated the weather in New York. And when he traveled to Los Angeles, he traveled here to LA actually with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. And he did a lot of arranging and writing for Paul Whiteman. That was one of the main things he noticed about Los Angeles was the weather. He really liked the weather. But it wasn't just the weather. You know, he found New York and the East Coast to be closed off to him, not just racially, but there was a cadre of elites who decided what was good music and what wasn't in New York. And it was very difficult to break through, even for somebody like him, who, despite his color, studied with George Chadwick and Edgar Varese. I mean, you just don't get better pedigrees. Mm-hmm. And yet he was, you know, scoffed at and not taken seriously there. And he found LA to be a much more open space, creatively speaking. He felt he had a lot more freedom in Los Angeles. So, you know, I was born there, Charles. Well, I was born in Whittier. All of us, you know, grew up there. I went, my first semester of college was at USC. So LA is my hometown. It will always be my hometown. Their home that they eventually moved to was right near the corner of Pico and Crenshaw. And it was one of the very first middle-class Black neighborhoods in LA. So I thought that was normal. I had no idea there was a time when you wouldn't have an entire neighborhood full of Black people that were, you know, professionals and middle class and above. But for him, that was a very rare experience. And for him, it also recreated what he knew in Little Rock, Arkansas. So, you know, there was a lot of things recommending Los Angeles to my grandfather.
Pretty much all of the work on the operas, right, was done during his Los Angeles period.
Yes, all the operas that exist. He had a lot of works that he destroyed, a lot of them, because he felt they were subpar. There were sketches and other things in opera that he wrote we no longer have access to. When he was very young, still a teenager, he wrote an opera to submit to a competition. And he used to joke about it because they sent him back a letter saying, "We like the music, but we really don't understand it." Because I think the entire opera was maybe 30 or 50 pages long. So there were other operas, but we will never see them.
But I mean, that's what it takes to be kind of belief in yourself and fire in the belly, as they say, to take on opera. And as I was reading his, you know, diary letters, this was really the genre in Western classical music that spoke to him. Like it came very early. If I remember, his stepfather played opera recordings. And so this wasn't a one-off. This was really where his heart was from the beginning.
For him, it began, as you say, when he was very young and his stepfather bought him a Victrola and played those Red Seal recordings in the very, very early years of the 20th century. And that's all he wanted to write. I mean, obviously not all, but that was his highest ambition. Mm-hmm. And it broke his heart that he never got a professional performance of a single opera during his lifetime. It broke his heart because he would send scores to the Metropolitan and they eventually told him, "Stop sending scores. We're not going to do any of them." He did get one professional performance, obviously. That would have been Troubled Island. It required a foreign-born music director to program it, Laszlo Halas. Mm-hmm. And when he presented that to the board, they said, "Laszlo, you can't do this one. It's written by a colored man." And that his response was, "Well, what color is he? I don't care." And they did it. Opera was always what he wanted to write. It was always what he wanted to listen to. And he wrote a number of them.
Let's talk about that a little bit, like what his operatic language was. These are all coming from a mature composer, somebody who's already been working at his craft for a long time. Opera is a difficult nut to crack in terms of getting productions. I think people don't always realize the amount of conviction and support you have to have from a house, from a conductor, from, because there are so many moving parts. So it's arguably the hardest genre to get performed by professional groups. And he worked so hard at making that happen. But the story of Highway 1 USA is an example of, yes, getting a performance, but at the level usually of colleges and universities, really people taking that on. And colleges and universities are often playing that kind of advocate role for new music, new voices, getting them performed.
Highway 1 was first performed, I think, at a high school. I will point out that yet again, you have a foreign-born conductor willing to produce the opera. It was not an American-born, it was a Russian-born conductor, Savitsky, just to make that really clear. But I do think that schools play such a role in having the freedom to be a little bit braver. They don't have the budgets of the LA Opera or the Met or, you know, the Houston Grand. So I see that as a good thing. Obviously, what he really wanted was a professional production. And the closing of Troubled Island, despite the passionate approval of the audience, I think it broke his heart. Honestly, I don't think he was ever the same. I mean, opera just, in so many ways, it forms these mileposts throughout his life. And I think the creation of Highway 1, it's a lovely, lovely piece, and it moves, right? I mean, Highway 1 moves. There's no lingering, but he was trying to create an opera that would be easier for people to perform. It has a smaller, much reduced orchestra. If you look at the orchestra for Highway 1 versus the orchestra for Troubled Island or even Minette Fontaine or any of the others, you know, it's much easier. You don't need to have a giant pit. And that was designed that way by him to make it so that it would get performances.
So this was the premiere at Coral Gables High School under the auspices of University of Miami with Dr. Fabian Savitsky at the podium. It was a hit. He received standing ovation. The New York Times reported like there was some buzz about its success. Yeah. And I have to believe it's, as you said, the story, it moves very quickly. And also, you know, when we say accessibility, I mean that as a compliment, that it was an accessibly theatrical musical style. And I wondered, could you just talk about how you think about the musical style of this opera?
I mean, first, I would say that although he tried to make it easier to produce, as a vocalist, he didn't make it easier to sing. You know, his music is deceptive. And I think that's true for both instrumentalists as it is true for vocalists. I was an oboe player before I was a vocalist. Sometimes people make the mistake of because the music is so accessible and rhythmic and melodic, thinking that it's going to be easy to play. And these vocal lines are tough. Mary in particular has such a varied type of singing. Her mood is changing constantly. And it's the same in here. This is emotional. This opera was originally called a Southern Interlude. And when I hear this music, you can hear that humidity of the South, right? Like it feels like molasses sometimes, and not in like that it's slow. Like I said, it moves, just that it has that slight, the blues notes, it has the narrative, you know, it's a storytelling the way that we often associate with a Southern style, and that sort of intimacy that also we associate with sort of Southern families, this emphasis on tradition and family and warmth. I think that the Southernness of this opera is not to be ignored. You know, another thing about his musical style is if you listen to the arias, many of them, most of them, they don't always have a definitive ending. It's more of a Wagnerian transition where it's just part of the conversation. And to me, again, that's a little bit more of a Southern thing. Like this whole opera is this conversation that's going on within a family's home. It's so intimate to me. I think the music is luscious. I mean, I think you can drink it in like a sweet tea. I don't want to belabor this point. You can just dig into it and really not stop digging.
I mean, this is very compact. It was something I noticed right away. I had listened to the recording, but I found that I have a deeper connection with the music when I get to see it produced and performed in stage with opera. And I think that's likely, you know, I can understand your grandfather's despair about that, because opera comes alive on stage. And as I was listening, it moves. You're right. Yeah. There's no lingering. There's no fat, as it were. It's very taut, so that as you get into an aria and out of it, there's no long interlude to get you in the mood of whatever's going to be expressed. And yeah. then some outro, as we would say, you know, to let yeah. you take that in. That kind of Wagnerian or Puccinian largesse is gone. It's really feels theatrical to me.
Yeah, very much so. Same to me. And you know, it's funny, I think about some of the one act operas I've sung in, things like L'Enfant et les Sortilèges, which is Ravel, which is theatrical, but in a different way, right? Like it's very staged, right? L'Enfant et les Sortilèges. Many one act operas are that way. Like they're, it feels in a way almost like we're all in on the joke. Like, oh, okay, this is opera being, now opera is going to lighten up.
And right.
And it, you're right. And it's so formally informal, but that is not what Highway One is. Highway One is as though you took an absolute, just a drama written for like an Arthur Miller play and set it to music. That is what it is like. And not just in terms of, as you say, the pace, but also in terms of taking everyday life and characters that we know, much like Arthur Miller often did, and turning them into people of dignity and people who have depth and nuance and whose tragedies and triumphs matter. And that's something I think that Highway One does really beautifully. And again, I you know, I'm biased, but I feel as though in this opera, it doesn't take you very long to care about the characters.
That is absolutely true. I also experienced that. And it was a little almost confusing because you don't expect that. I mean, there was something so kind of simple, and your grandfather uses that word a lot about simple people, just people. And I was thinking, since Still was using a language that did owe something to kind of very Italian verismo.
Yeah.
Even though there can be themes of vengeance and high drama and all of that, it comes back to this couple who own a gas station.
They own a gas station, and the sets usually look like, you know, something you'd find in a 1970s Denny's, right? Like they don't have any money. They're right. doing fine. But they're just trying to be the best people they can be, right? And they're making choices that turn out to be wrong choices, but there was no way for them to know that, right? Like they're just trying to do the best they can to be good people and make it. And you know, when you read his diaries, it's so funny because I'm writing a book about my great grandmother, his mother, who was just a remarkable human being. And at so many interviews, he said, "It was my mother, it's my mother, it's my mother." He was always crediting her, and nobody ever paid any attention to that. But in any case, I was just in Fayetteville at his archives at the University of Arkansas and reading through all of the diaries. And it's so interesting because he writes these brief diary entries where he'll be like, "Shep tore up the couch pillow, Stokowski came by, scored victory tide, refertilizes the squash." Like, what? Wait, sorry, what? And this happens over and over and over again. He has one thing where he's like talking about the traffic and the really bad smog, and he hates his neighbor's dog that they leave out all night. And he's talking about this. And then he's like, went to dinner at Hattie McDaniel's, you know, came home, blah, 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 had stomach ache. And you're like, sorry, go back.
Hattie McDaniel's? Wait.
Yeah, exactly. And this is constant. You know, he'll just be like, you know, got a call from Percy Grainger. He seems irritated. You know, the dog was, you know, impertinent. It's just this constant juxtaposition of the fabulous and the absolutely prosaic in his own life. And you know, in Highway One, you know that he's not writing about people he didn't know. These are people he knows, and these are people he is and was and continued to be. There's no condescension here. There's no stereotypes. He's not trying to portray the noble poor or anything, you know. He's just talking about regular people who are doing the best they can. And it's so clear that he's doing that with respect and sensitivity, and not with an idea that he's doing something kind by writing about the regular people.
I loved, first of all, I hope people will that are listening will consider checking out some of the many books available where you can get some of those diary entries and just take in that fascinating life, which reminds us all to have those daily appreciations of the people we meet, the fabulous and just the everyday, right?
Yeah.
That grace our lives. And it comes through, as I watched at the opening night and took it in, I did have a question, and because it says set in the present,
yeah,
which of course now for us is the past.
Yeah.
And also your grandfather talked about the fact that he did not want this to be, unlike some of his past operas, which dealt very specifically either with Black lives or with other ethnicities. This was one that he kind of said, look, it's not about race, right? This is not non-racial. Since he was a Black composer, and because in many cases, historical Black colleges and universities pulled in the 70s, especially, and Black opera companies really pushed this work in front, it's associated often, you know, this is a Black story. But for me, I was struck with, yes, Southern, but I was imagining the story of simple people trying to deal with a younger member of the family, some sense of being that generational transition between, right? The mother asking somebody to take the lead on helping a younger family member. I felt like this could be staged in many ways.
Yeah, by many people.
By many people. Who are these people for us today, or for you? You do so much about communication in your professional life, about speaking and having conversations. Who are these people talking to us?
Yeah, that's so interesting that you asked that, because honestly, this opera, if nothing else, is an argument for why you shouldn't let things simmer. You should just get everything out in the open. Yes, he had an obligation that his mother placed on him to take care of his younger brother, but did he ever talk to his mother about that? What were the limitations of that obligation? Because, you know, you can't help but think that's not what she wanted for her son, for either of her children. You know, it's an argument for why they didn't have these conversations earlier on about expectations for Nate. Why Mary didn't have conversations about it bothering her more before it became, I mean, no spoilers, but before it became a problem, mm-hmm. and more than a problem. He put it in the present because it's supposed to be the present of wherever we are. And mm-hmm. there's nothing in this opera that wouldn't absolutely happen right now today and is in some form happening. You know, family meant so much to my grandfather. You know, people say that a lot, but when I say that about him, I mean that music was all he wanted to do, but in terms of how he wanted to live, he gave it all for his family. You know, another thing that you notice when you read through his diaries is we're talking about a man who absolutely believed in splitting duties half and half. You constantly see him talking about going to the grocery store and buying clothes for the children and making dinner and going to the kids' school to pick them up or whatever it may be. This is not somebody who expected his wife. You know, he married an incredibly talented, strong woman, and he had every intention of allowing her to continue her career. Every intention. My grandmother wrote the libretto for Highway One.
And we're talking, of course, about your grandmother, Verna Arvey, who was, as you mentioned, a classical pianist and also a writer, an established writer of nonfiction.
You know, in fact, he often remarks in the diaries of how irritated he is when people, for example, my grandmother wrote the libretto for Highway One. He would get so irritated when people would say, "Why William Grant Still?" and they would leave her out. I remember one of the diaries I just read in his entry, and I think this is one the 1950s, he said, he got programs from a performance of The Little Song That Wanted to Be a Symphony, which is this delightful piece. And he said, Verna's name was omitted. My grandmother's name, Verna Arvey. I regret this very much because she, as a writer of the narrative, should have received as much consideration as I did. And this is a continuing theme over and over that people are not giving her the credit that she deserves. It's the same thing as I was saying, that he kept crediting his mother as being one of the most important guiding forces. That's not what people wanted to hear about. They wanted to hear about what he thought about Puccini.
Right.
Right. But he kept telling them, Puccini was less of an influence on me than my mother. This is an opera about family and family ties and love and the limitations of love and how easy it is to take advantage of those who love you, because it feels wrong to put limits on love. And this is something that my grandfather grappled with his whole life.
He was ahead of his time. I mean, I was astonished at his reading the diaries, just his involvement with family, his love for his wife, Verna, and their partnership was extraordinary. And I did read some very moving things where people had said, William Grant Still, the composer in terms of the operas, is actually a partnership.
To say that he was ahead of his time, you're saying a lot. I mean, first of all, she was ahead of her time.
Yes.
As a teenager, she traveled to South America and all through Central America to study. She was fluent in several languages. She studied South American dance. She had concert performances with Koussevitzky and all kinds of other incredible conductors. She was very accomplished as a pianist, as a journalist. She kept her own name. They were married in 1939,
yes.
I guess I should know that, maybe.
Yeah, 39.
And she kept, not only did she keep her name, but almost all of her entire Jewish family, except for her sister, disowned her, essentially, because she married a Black man. And she had a spine of steel, which was such a theme in my grandfather's life. His mother, of course, was just a force of nature. That's what he admired. He wasn't cowed by it, obviously. He was incredibly successful and he was his own person. But that's what he wanted, was a woman who had her own life and had her own interests and made him better. You know, he was constantly talking about how Verna, my grandmother, would bring him ideas and bring him information he never knew before and find things for him, sort musical sources. You know, he wrote the Danzas de Panama. He wrote on themes from folk music of the South, Panamanian dances in English that were brought to him by my grandmother. That was a constant theme for him. And you can see it in the operas as well. I mean, look at how beautifully Mary is written. I mean, what a tour de force role for someone to dig into. But in many of his operas, you have that. Minette Fontaine, oh, holy cow. And it's not just the lead character in Minette Fontaine who is just a force, just these unbelievable roles. These are not shrinking violets. These are not victims. None of these women are the tools of either fate or some man. These are strong women.
Much of my work is on female characters in opera. And I'm always looking at that. And I mean, first I was moved by not only Mary's strength and her frustration, but also the scene with Aunt Lou. That female friendship does not show up very often on opera as well. So to see not only Mary and her love for Bob, but also these two women sharing something very personal, which is only, you know, Aunt Lou's thing about, you know, I've known you longer than that, actually, and about losing a child. That's, I found it so interesting that's in there, because it's not actually central to the drama. It's a natural.
It passes the Bechdel test.
Right? It passes the Bechdel test. And I thought, what an extraordinary thing. And then when Mary, we'll just say, gets into a situation and it could look like we're going to end, you know, is this going to be one of those things where a woman's going to have to be harmed or humiliated or something? What's going to happen? Something that really struck me with this performance being in the audience. And again, this is the difference between seeing a streaming or listening to a recording with the score, which I had with me. I couldn't have predicted this. The responses of the audience to certain moments in this opera, the laughter, but also gasps. And in canonic opera, which we're hearing all the time, most people know what's going to happen. And I realized that many of those people had no idea about what they were going to see. And they were responding in real time to the drama. And it was such a pleasure to me. And it really told me how important it is for companies to try to put these newer or unknown works in front of audiences, because surprise and astonishment, engagement with the drama without actually knowing what's going to happen is somewhat a rarity for opera audiences. And I loved it. There was a big enough gasp, not just a few people, at certain moments that I thought, wow, that's drama. And opera is drama. And I loved seeing that and hearing that.
I mean, one of the great things about this that makes this opera so very universal is it's about dreams, right? Everybody in this opera talks about their dreams at some point, pretty much, all the main characters. And, you know, interestingly enough, the opera premiered in Miami in 1963. Mm-hmm. I mean, what else happened in 1963? The I Have a Dream speech during the march in Washington, right? Like, this is a time in our country when we were thinking about dreams and who has the right to them and at what cost are our dreams realized. And I think that's one of the things when you're talking about surprise. Yeah, I think it's one of the things that makes this opera so very gripping, is because we all have dreams, and some of them we've attained and some of them we haven't and never will. And that's a universal experience. So yeah, I really hope it does catch on and other opera companies do it. You know, he wrote it to be doable and it is producible.
I'm glad that you highlighted that theme of the dream, because it's so seamless between, let's say, declamatory, more spoken, although it's being sung, settings, and where he indicates aria. And those arias are, two of those are about that, about dreams. Bob's idea of, like, am I ever going to achieve my dreams? And Nate's,
and his mother's dream for...
Yes. Yeah. His mother's dream. And then Nate's dismissal.
Does he know of dreams?
Yes.
Yeah. Mary's dream of a child. Yeah.
Yes. That resonance of, as you say, that is a timeless theme of, where are we in our lives? Have the sacrifices have been worth it? Have they been worth it? And that the simple things can be dreams, that they are worthy of our aspirational energy, right? It's not just about achieving fame and fortune.
The other thing with Mary and also with Bob is, you know, what happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore? Does it stink like rotten meat? Like, Hollywood is the land of dreams, right? He wrote this while he was there. He did work for the Hollywood companies for a while. Dreams aren't always positive. They're value neutral. They can make us better. They can make us worse. And sometimes, as in the dreams African-Americans have always had about the United States, and America has never lived up to those dreams, they can dry up like a raisin in the sun. So again, I do think, as you started out this interview talking about how this isn't a racial piece, and it's not, this is one of the reasons it's not, because the themes are of family, of love, and of dreams. Those are something absolutely everybody, and not just in the US, every human being can relate to those things.
I love that. And I think that people will respond that way.
I hope so.
So I want to thank Celeste Headlee for joining me today for this fascinating and enlightening conversation about her grandfather, William Grant Still.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Tickets are available now at laopera.org. If you enjoyed listening to LA Opera's Behind the Curtain, subscribe and leave a rating or review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you listen. Don't forget to share this episode with your friends on your favorite social media, and we'll see you at the opera.